Good morning, church. It's good to see all of you. I especially appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you and through this entire week to let you know a little bit about me. I've been here a few times before as Jeff's nephew, and I've actually spoken here. I was trying to remember how long ago it was that I spoke here. It was a few years back. I think it was, 2 or 3 years ago that I spoke here. And, so I'm back here. Also, you are here for something very momentous. This is my first gospel meeting in North America. So you get to hear what has not been heard on this side of the planet. My first two were actually in South Africa a few years ago, but here I really appreciate the opportunity to speak here. My series this morning, and through the whole week, I've titled "Ordinary is God's Extraordinary," And what I want to accomplish with that is I want us to consider a few things, because often I encounter people within the church, not necessarily within the church, sometimes people outside of the church, or even I find myself falling into a certain trap of the mind where we'll read certain biblical accounts of these fantastic, extraordinary, huge, wonderful events that further the cause of God and God's people and show God's power and might. And if you would think about like certain events like the Exodus of Moses leading the people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt, out of slavery and bondage to the promised land, or you think of Joshua coming in and taking that promised land, or you think of the stories of like David defeating Goliath, or the children of Israel coming back out of Babylonian captivity, rebuilding the walls, rebuilding the temples. You think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are thrown into the fiery furnace because of their faith. And you think about the trials and travails of the apostles as they strive to bring the church and the message of Jesus to the entire world, and all the various things that they accomplish, and all the great things that they do. And we hold these people up, Moses and Abraham and Joshua and David and the apostle Peter and the apostle Paul, and we say, wow, those were great men. And too bad I'm not one of them. We will be in awe of their writings and their accomplishments and the great things that they did for God, and we'll fall into this mind trap and say, well, of course Moses led the people out of Egypt because he was Moses. I mean, he was Moses, right? Of course David defeated Goliath because David, I mean, that was David. They were extraordinary people. And we put these people up on a pedestal, and instead of thinking them as models for us, for how we can accomplish God's work for us specifically through God's Spirit and power working through us, instead we say, well, they're special. They were a special case. God worked through them because they were so great, so powerful, so intelligent. God can't do that through me. And we have all these various excuses we go through. I'm not rich enough. I'm not talented enough. I don't have the right work or education background for what I should, or what God needs to be accomplished. I'm not righteous enough. I have too many skeletons in my closet. I'm not well known enough. I'm not the sharpest crayon in the Crayola box. I'm not the kind of person that God can use. And if you think about it in terms of when Jesus told the parable of the talents, we'll think of ourselves as the one talent man. We'll see the man with 5 talents, And the man with 5 talents goes out and gets 5 talents more. Of course he does. He's the 5-talent man. Of course he's going to go out and get 5 more talents. And then we see the 2-talent man, and he goes out and gets 2 more talents. Of course the 2-talent man's going to go get 2 more talents. He's the 2-talent man. But then we look at ourselves and we say, well, I only have 1 talent. So I can't do anything with it. I just better bury it. God can't do anything. I mean, yeah, God can do something with a 5-talent man, with a 2-talent man. God can't do anything with the 1-talent man. And so the point of this series is, I have a few goals in mind of this series. The first one is to demystify some of these biblical heroes of faith that we put up on a pedestal. Not to say that what they accomplished isn't great, but we too often make these men into demigods sometimes in our own minds. It's not to belittle the great things that they accomplished, but to understand what they accomplished was not so much because of how great they were, but by how great God was working through them. Because we'll look and we'll notice that as we go through these various lessons, we'll see ordinary, flawed, sinful human beings just like us. They had their own problems, their own sins, their own shortcomings, and what they accomplished was not so much what they were good at, but in spite of the fact of what they were bad at. The second goal of this series is to show that those same struggles, same doubts and questions and challenges and sins that you and I face today are the exact same struggles and questions and doubts and challenges and sins that those great people of faith faced. These people that we're going to look at are not perfect examples of humanity, but they are examples of people who dealt with and overcame their struggles and doubts and questions and sins. And then third, and even more importantly, I think, out of even those two, if you would turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, is to encourage you to not only think of yourself as being capable of being used by God, but to also not judge others by earthly standards, and rather use God's standards in how we understand our own abilities and how we push each other along. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse starting in 26, if I can get there, starting in verse 26, Paul says, "For consider your calling, brethren." So here is Paul saying, consider your calling. Who are you when God called you to be a Christian? Consider your calling, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. Here is, you know, consider yourself. Do you consider yourself the smart person? Do you consider yourself the strong person, the person who has it all together? Do you consider, are you the famous person, the person who has all the wealth, all the money, all the influence? Most likely not. But God, verse 27, has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. The base things of the world and the despised, God has chosen those things that are not, that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. And so, what we need to understand that if we consider ourselves to be the less intelligent or the less capable or the poorer is that God chose us. That's not an excuse to get out of doing something. In fact, it's just more proof that God wants you to do something, that God can accomplish something through you if you are not the best. But the other thing to realize also is that's how he called the rest of us as well. And so sometimes we will say, okay, well, everybody should be a little bit patient with me because I'm not the smartest person. I'm not the most talented. But brother so-and-so over here, he shouldn't be doing this because he doesn't have the right educational background. He doesn't have that. He doesn't have this. And what we need to understand is when we do something like that and we say, well, that person, you know, he really shouldn't be doing that, or he really can't accomplish this particular thing, is that when we do that, we're judging based upon the earth's standards of what is possible. Instead of basing, our judgments on what God sees. And God chooses the weak things of the world to shame the wise. And so what God chooses, we need to also consider and choose for ourselves as well. It's not weakness to believe that God can accomplish great things through weakness. It's not unintelligent to believe that God can accomplish great things through those who are not as smart as other people or anything. So we need to define success, define talent, define what is good and godly based upon how God defines success, and not quench the spirit, which sometimes can happen if we say, well, you can't do this for God because you don't have this. You're not a good speaker. You don't have the right education. You don't have this. You don't do this. God can do that even without all those various things. So to sum up, the three things that I really want to accomplish this week is to demystify some of these biblical heroes and bring them back down to humanity and understand them as humans. And also understand that we are just like them, and start viewing strength and success in the way that God views it, rather than how our world and our culture and society define strength and success. So with that being said, with our remainder of the time that I have, I want us to consider the story of Joseph. If you would, turn back to Genesis. The book of Genesis. And in chapter 37 of Genesis, we have the dreams of Joseph. Now, Joseph is number 11 of 12 sons. And especially, and so being number 11 of 12 already automatically puts him as, the runt, or one of the runts of the litter. But even back in that day and time, especially when birth order and the firstborn and everybody got those kinds of people got prevalence, Joseph is just way, 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 way down on the list of importance in the family. And Joseph has a few dreams that reveal God's plans for him. He has one dream where he and his brothers are out gathering sheaves of wheat, and all of his brothers' sheaves bow down before Joseph's sheaf of wheat. And then he has a dream where he and his brothers are stars, and his father and mother are the sun and moon, and the sun and moon and the other 11 stars bow down before Joseph's star. And when Joseph tells these dreams to his brothers and to his father, his brothers and father make the connection. It's not Joseph saying, here's the interpretation. His father and brothers immediately recognize that dream, what the dream is saying, is that his brothers and actually his father will at some point bow down before Joseph. And that's the most preposterous thing that could possibly ever happen. You know, that just has to be a fever dream of Joseph's, even if he had that dream. Because especially in that day and time, when birth order went a long way in not only in determining who got the more inheritance, but who got more respect, it's just ridiculous to think that Joseph, number 11, would be the one who would be respected the most and revered the most out of the family. But so here, at a young age, Joseph's maybe around 17 at this time, he gets a clue from God through these dreams, what God has prepared for Joseph in the future. And knowing the whole story, we've gone through this story a lot of times, going through different Bible classes and everything. We know what's going to happen to Joseph. Joseph is going to end up as second in command of Egypt. He's going to become the second most powerful man on the face of the earth at that time, and maybe even consider he might even be the most powerful man, because he'll actually be doing things and controlling things. Pharaoh just is kind of the figurehead at this point. Joseph's actually going to go out and accomplish things and save things and do things. So God has planned for Joseph to become one of the most powerful men alive in his day and age. And he's not only going to become powerful, he's going to save his family from the famine. He's going to save countless families in Egypt from the famine. And he's going to save countless families in other parts of the world from the famine through what he does. And he's going to do that through his economic and taxation policies. And he's going to do it with his administrative skills and his landholding policies that he administrates on the behalf of the Pharaoh. And not only is Joseph going to adequately prepare Egypt for a famine through his tax policy, he's also going to consolidate the wealth and power and the landholdings of the Pharaoh, and even make the Pharaoh a more powerful person in the end through Joseph's actions. So I want you to think about, what God is saying, I have planned for you, Joseph. This is what you're going to be. You're going to be a powerful man who's going to accomplish great things, save people, consolidate power for the Pharaoh. You're going to do all these great political, economic, and humanitarian things for me. And he doesn't tell Joseph that all at the beginning, but that's what God has planned for him. So I want you to think about this in terms of what we do, what we're going through right now. We have a Republican presidential nomination thing going through. And whether you're a Republican or not, the Democrats go through it too as well. And whenever we're deciding and we're looking at possible nominees for the president, what are the kinds of things that we consider? Okay, yeah, I could see myself voting for this guy. That's the kind of person that I want to run for president, or this is the kind of person I want to be president. What kind of things do we look for? What kind of person does that potential nominee for president, the leader of the free world, although that's more and more becoming the president of China now, but beyond that, who do we want running the world? Who do we trust with the ability to make the world better, make our lives better? So if you're an Egyptian, and say you are told at the time when the Pharaoh actually chooses Joseph, say you are an Egyptian, and you're told, okay, what we need is we need a political leader. We need to find somebody who can administrate a new tax policy, make sure to collect food and then distribute it, and not only to the people of Egypt but to people all across the known world. And so, if we think about all, what the job is, and say you are an Egyptian on the nominating committee to find out, okay, let's find this perfect man who's going to fill this position. We'd say, okay, he needs to be a political leader because this is an important job. So if he's not a politician already, he needs to at least know something about politics. He needs to have been in Pharaoh's court. He needs to know how things work and operate, so that he can grease the wheels, get things going. It involves taxation and redistribution. So he needs to be an economist. He needs to know about economics. He needs to know about math and arithmetic. He needs to know all these different things because that's complicated stuff. It involves creating institutions that are going to collect taxes and then redistribute the grain as necessary through these famine years. So he needs to be an administrative manager. He needs to have that experience. He needs to be a bureaucrat because there's going to be a lot of paperwork too. He needs to know all those different things. It involves trade, not only within Egypt, but it involves trade with the world outside of Egypt. So not only does he need to have mercantile experience, he needs to be adept at foreign policy. He needs to know how to deal with people from different cultures and different lands. So obviously, with all this big list, he needs to be educated. I mean, he has to be like Ivy League, like, you know, Thebes University kind of level kind of guy. And also, not only that, he's saving Egypt first and foremost. So let's remember that the most important thing is that he has an Egyptian flag lapel pin on his suit so that we know that he's a good Egyptian, because we can only have a good Egyptian leader. No illegal immigrants can fill this position. Obviously, they need to serve the Egyptian gods. We need to know that we can trust them. So, in the Egyptian mind, if they were told, we need a leader who can do this, you know, you'd probably think that's kind of how, and that's also very similar to how we think about what we want as a leader. We want somebody who's smart, who has a lot of different kinds of, experience in all these different and various different kinds of areas of expertise, and especially he needs to have that American flag lapel pin, or he's not a good American, and he obviously is disqualified. But I want us to consider, is that the person that God chooses for this big, important job? Is that the kind of person that God says can actually accomplish what needs to be accomplished? Did you ever take a job aptitude test while you were in school? I did when I was in junior high. They give us this, you know, Scantron kind of thing to see what our interests are, what our aptitude is, and then you send it in, and then it tells you, okay, you have an aptitude for this area of work, and it'll give you a list of these kinds of jobs that maybe when you're in junior high or high school, you should start thinking about where you're going to be going, what kind of job you're going to be working toward. And not only do the job, it says, okay, you have an aptitude for these kinds of jobs, but it also say, okay, if you want to become, like, say, a doctor, what do you need to do and what do you need to accomplish in order to become a doctor? Well, to become a doctor, you need to go to college, and then you need to go to medical school, and then you need to go through tests and be certified and all those other things. So you know, okay, here is the career path I need to take if I want to be a doctor. I need to go to college. I need to get good enough grades in high school so I can go to college, so that I can go to medical school, so that I can get certified and I can become a doctor. If I don't want to become a doctor, if I want to become a beautician, Medical school isn't going to do me any good. I need to go to cosmology school or anything like that. And so political leaders are a little bit more unique in that, you know, there isn't exactly a set, okay, this is the path that you go to become a political leader. But generally, we want our political leaders to be well-educated. We choose a lot of Ivy Leaguers, a lot of people from very prestigious universities. We say we don't like politicians, but we prefer our presidents to at least have some political experience. And so we look and we say, okay, we want a powerful man. What is the career path that he's going to take? What is the career path of this particular person who's going to become the most powerful man in the world? So from the Egyptian perspective, again, as we think about this, so maybe somebody from Pharaoh's court, maybe a provincial governor, is shown that he has the ability, that he's gone through the various hoops and the tax issues on a smaller scale, Someone who's worked up their ladder in Egyptian politics? Or maybe even we'll say, okay, maybe we'll go outside the box. Maybe a military leader. A military leader at least shows that he has leadership abilities, that he can guide and direct people to do certain things. And to be a military leader, you've got to be smart. So maybe either we're looking at like a provincial governor, or we're looking at a general, or we're looking at some kind of person like that to fill this role. But that's not who God picks. God's career path for leader and savior of the known world was a shepherd boy who became a slave, who became a prisoner, who was forgotten for 2 years, and then made leader of the world. That is God's career path to success. And I want you to think about that. Who in their right mind would choose somebody whose highest, the highest level of achievement they ever attained was when they were 17 and they were an assistant shepherd? That was Joseph's highest position ever before he became second in command in Egypt. Because from then on, it was downhill for Joseph. I want you to think about that in terms of today. How many of us would be willing to nominate a Republican or Democrat at the conventions this year, nominate them straight out of jail? Somebody in the federal penitentiary, somebody in Leavenworth, Kansas, let's nominate them for president. Who's gonna go for that? Nobody. Except God. And so there's a couple lessons that I want us to get from this as we think about this. And I'm going to pick up some of these lessons again when we talk about Gideon on Monday. But the first lesson I want us to consider is that what we think is necessary to accomplish a goal that God has set, what we think is necessary to accomplish that goal is not necessarily what God sees as necessary to accomplish that goal. True, when you look at Joseph, and I've given that kind of, that career path, you can look, when Joseph was a slave, he did the best that he could when he was a slave and he became the head slave. And when he was a prisoner, he was on such good behavior that he became a head prisoner. But even say that, okay, so Joseph's the head prisoner. Do you still want him to be, so he's the best of the worst. Do you still want him to be leader of the world? So yeah, sure, Joseph, in this career path that God had planned for Joseph, Joseph learned important lessons. He learned important lessons about hard work. He learned important lessons about leadership in the limited amount of leadership that he had. And he learned about, but that still in no way prepared him for the leadership position that he then had. What God was preparing Joseph for more, and what God considered more important than the administrative skills, than economic understanding, than political clout. What God saw was more important was that Joseph learned patience and faith and perseverance even in the most difficult and hard times. God views righteousness and faith in difficult times as more important skills than what Joseph knows, than what Joseph has had experience doing. And there's also something else, is that God has a greater purpose in mind for Egypt than just finding a leader. Most often we'll define what needs to be accomplished in how we understand the problem. So I gave you the problem in terms of Egypt needs a new leader. Egypt is going to face these various things. What kind of person do I need? Or what kind of person do we need to look for? And actually, that wasn't the problem that Egypt had. Yeah, Egypt was going to face an economic problem. But they didn't need an economist to fix it. Egypt was facing a leadership problem, but Egypt didn't need a political leader to fix it. In fact, what God's purpose was to save the world through Joseph, to reunite Joseph with his family in love, and to show God's glory and wisdom throughout this entire situation. So when we consider, okay, what do we need to accomplish? What do I need to accomplish as an individual? What do we need to accomplish as a church? We need to consider, am I defining what needs to be done in human terms, or am I defining what needs to be done in God's terms? Because sometimes we'll say, okay, whatever problem, we need to fill the church building. We need more people to come to the church building. So we say it's a numbers problem. And so how do you get more people in? And then we start thinking of all these different ideas about, okay, how do we solve the numbers problem? And we say, okay, well, you need more entertainment. We need more of this or more of that. Kids these days love rock bands, so we need to bring in contemporary services. We need to do all these other things. And then we'll get the numbers. But is the numbers really the problem or really the issue? The issue is not about numbers at all. God would say, what the real issue is are you serving me in spirit and truth? Are you cultivating an atmosphere of edification amongst each other? Are you building each other up in love and patience? And if we start thinking about that and say, what are our real needs? What do we really need? Then those other things that we thought were needs, like numbers or like attendance or other things, those will take care of themselves. But it's what really needs to be accomplished that we really need to focus on. So when you consider not only what you do personally, And that's usually how we define these various things. I'm not smart enough. If only I knew this, or if only I had this kind of education. But really, it's not about that. Is that in your life, are you being controlled by the Spirit? Are you walking with the Spirit? Are you walking with the Spirit in love? Because love convinces more people and accomplishes God's will much more than if you know things. As Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13, you know, knowledge, prophecies, those things, those will go away. Those will fade away. But love lasts forever. So when we consider what we need to do, what the church needs to do, when we're considering people for leadership positions in the church especially, do we look for the person who has the better earthly qualifications? Do we say, okay, we need a preacher, we need to find some elders. What do we need? We need somebody who looks good, we need somebody who speaks good, we need somebody who has this or that. And are all those things superfluous? And in focusing on those things, are we going to let the real good person go by forgotten in jail, like Joseph? If we focus too much on earthly things, we may just let Joseph slip by unaware, and then some other place that's more in tune with what God wants will pick up that person and say, yes, this is great. So I believe I'll close it here for now. But I want to reemphasize just a moment again to think about this. Who God chooses as a leader, who God chooses as a savior, who God chooses wasn't based upon how many years of school he had, how good of a speaker he was, how much he knew about economics or taxes or politics or any of those kinds of things. God chose a man who stayed with God no matter what. No matter the fact that he was sold into slavery. No matter the fact, into a country that he didn't even belong in. No matter the fact that he was falsely accused and thrown into prison. No matter even the fact when he found a way into Pharaoh's ear and he told the butler, hey, remember me when you get out of jail, and the butler forgot him for 2 years. Even in all those cases, Joseph remained faithful to God and believed in God and stayed with God and then eventually was rewarded by God. And one final passage I definitely want to is in Genesis. Genesis chapter 50. After the death of Jacob, after Joseph and his brothers had been reconciled together, but and all of them had moved back down to Egypt, and Joseph and Jacob dies, and Joseph's brothers are a little worried. Okay, maybe Joseph was just treating us well because for father's sake, but now that father's gone, maybe Joseph's going to turn on us, and they're afraid. And verse 18 of chapter 50, it says, then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. So here is one of the several times where Joseph's dream comes true. They fall down on their knees before Joseph. Behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. And I will provide for you and your little ones, so be comforted. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Here is the big picture. Even, and we look at even in the hard times, even in evil things, God accomplishes his will. So, look, going back to 1 Corinthians and looking at this, God chooses the weak things of the world, God chooses the lowly things of the world, God even accomplishes his will through the evil things of the world, to accomplish his will and to save many people. And let's remember that. God is more powerful than anything. And he can empower you as well. I'll leave that with you this morning. Thank you.